Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's vow that he will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq, where we are already fighting with Iran as an ally against ISIL, while at the same time we are preparing to fight ISIL in Syria against Iran's ally, the Assad regime. With this just one example of the complexities and contradictions about to embroil us, Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and author of the daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss the president's war plans, which already have Russia warning the U.S. against airstrikes without the backing of the U.N., over which Russia and China have veto power on the U.N. Security Council. Then we will speak with Richard Rubenstein, University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University and author of Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. We will look into why a reluctant Obama chose war when he is trying to extricate America from lost wars in the Middle East, and why we are stuck in a cycle of constant wars, none of which we have won since World War II, and why we can't talk to our enemies unless they agree to our terms before we talk to them. Then finally, we will discuss the other 9/11, the 41st anniversary of the U.S.-backed brutal military coup against Chile's socialist government in 1973 that resulted in thousands of Chilean citizens being tortured, murdered, and disappeared. Catherine Haidt, a professor of political science and chair of political science at Vassar College and author of The Politics of Memory in Chile, From Pinochet to Bachelet, joins us to discuss the slow process of truth, reconciliation, and justice underway in Chile and the economic as well as human rights crimes committed by Pinochet's family and cronies. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And in President's speech to the nation, he said, "I have made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven." I don't know that he made the case that what's happening in Syria is a direct threat to the United States, but of course, the beheading of two American journalists in Syria by ISIL have certainly captured the attention of the American people. So is there a bit of a disconnect there between this group that's clearly punching above its weight and the idea that the lone superpower has to sort of take it on in this, you know, rather public and somewhat grandiose way?
Well, that's the real question here. And I guess Americans do want to do something. And we can't allow a group like this to kill two Americans in such a public fashion and not respond strongly. And also, ISIS, in killing the Yazidis, driving them out of their homeland, scaring the Christians out of Mosul, had really begun to spread into regions. It was important the United States stop this and begin to roll them back. Obviously, the president has promised that he is going to he ultimately is going to destroy them. And whether he can do that with the means at his disposal is the real question. And there are some definite downsides for President Obama and the United States in trying to do this, largely because we don't have an answer for bringing justice to the big sweep of Sunni territory, which stretches between Damascus and Baghdad. And we have two very sectarian regimes in Damascus and another one in Baghdad that we have partnered with, at least in Iraq. And in part, ISIL has been able to conquer this big stretch of land between Iraq and Syria, the size of Great Britain. There are about 6 million people there because the Sunnis that live there feel great injustice and persecuted. We can go and destroy the leadership of ISIS and hunt down its weaponry and so forth. But can we bring justice to these people? That's the real question. And that's the only thing that will stop the radicalization of the region and the tumult there. That's the question that's going to weigh on the president as he begins to bomb.
But if the president's taken the decision that he appears to have taken, he's already selling out the Sunni in Iraq, the tribes, for example, who are the only people who could really get rid of the Islamic State from the inside. And these are the same people that saved George W. Bush's bacon, if you will, with the surge. And here we are selling them out and basically, you know, turning their fate over to the Iranians, who they despise, and the government in Baghdad, who they despise. There's no way in the world that the Iranians and the Shia-dominated government in Baghdad that we're supporting are going to liberate the Sunni people from ISIS. They're going to kill them.
Well, that is the dilemma. Is the Middle East has collapsed into this sectarian warfare with Shiites on one side and Sunnis on the other. And that leaves America with terrible choices. And the president said he did not want to make America into the army, an arm of the Shiites in this war. But America has very few choices. Unless it's going to go nation build and create a Sunni stand stretching between Iraq and Syria, it's going to have to team up with the government in Baghdad, which is very sectarian, or with the Kurds in the north of Iraq, which we've already done. And the Kurds don't want to rule over these Arabs either. So we don't have a partner that's ideal in this region. And that's a conundrum. And I think that's why President Obama has been so reluctant to get into this. But ISIS has provoked America and has become a real threat in the region. And we couldn't stand by.
And Joshua, the meeting in Jeddah with all of the foreign ministers and Secretary of State John Kerry, with Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, and the United Emirates, as well as NATO member Turkey, who were there, but they didn't sign the statement, which is a little bit vague. But in terms of the subject that I'm calling you about, since it's your area of expertise, Syria, already Russia has warned the U.S. against using airstrikes in Syria, and the Russian foreign ministry is saying that without the backing of the U.N., it would be an act of aggression and a gross violation of international law. I don't know exactly when they're planning on starting to bomb and what they're going to bomb, but my understanding is that this situation in Syria is such a confusing patchwork of various factions that it's next to impossible to figure out who's on your side, and that should have been made clear from the beheadings of the two journalists. I mean, the employer of James Foley, thought they were negotiating with Syrian Air Force intelligence, and supposedly or apparently, they Syrian intelligence, Assad's people, handed over Foley to ISIS. And then the same is true with Sotloff, the most recent casualty of the beheadings. He, his family believed that they thought they were dealing with the Free Syrian Army, and they end up finding him being beheaded by ISIS. So it just seems to be, to my mind, almost next to impossible to know who these people are and what factions they are. So who do we know that's on our side? And conversely, who do we bomb if we've figured out who's on the other side?
Right. Well, we know who the ISIS people are, and we can figure that out. They've made enemies of everybody, not only the other Syrian militias, which they've been fighting since January of this year. The many Syrian militias have been fighting against ISIS, and there's probably at least 8,000 or 9,000 people have been killed in this inter-militia war. But they've also been fighting against the Syrian government. President Obama said we are not going to side with the Syrian government. He's asked within the first 2 months of this uprising in 2010, he said that President Assad had to step aside and he cannot regain his legitimacy, he said just the other night. So he's refusing to work with the government overtly, as he is working with the government of Iraq. That leaves us with the Syrian rebels. And there's a bill going before Congress in the coming week asking for $500 million to help fund and train rebel groups in Syria. The problem with this is that there are many different rebel groups. We are presently arming and funding about 12 or 14 different militias in the north of Syria and perhaps 60 different smaller groups in the south of Syria. We have been unable in the last 3.5 years to unite the many factions in Syria. The CIA says there's about 1,500 armed militias in Syria. If we build up these militias without uniting them, we're going to get Libya or Somalia. The president does not want to do that, and he won't want that kind of chaos. So this leaves us with a classic counterterrorism operation where we're hunting and destroying members of the Islamic State who have chopped off the heads of these Americans and who threaten both Iraq and Syria. And how we're going to build something to replace them is the real unanswered question. And the president did not really provide an answer in his speech. And I don't think he really has an answer at this point.
But just in terms of the confusion over who's on our side and who we're fighting and who's fighting who, there was just a bomb blast, or actually it wasn't a bomb blast, it was a sophisticated chemical weapon attack that killed the leader of Ahrar al-Sham, which is Free Men of the Levant. And that was apparently a very effective Islamist force, and 50 of their members, including their leader, were in the basement of a very fortified compound, and yet they were killed by what appears to be a sophisticated chemical weapon. So you ask yourself, well, who has those kind of weapons? Is it the Islamic State or ISIL, or is it the Syrian government? And now, of course, Ahrar al-Sham are blaming the Islamic State because they'd previously killed some of their people. But to me, this just indicates the incredible, you know, it reminds me of the old saying about the Kremlin during the Cold War, the enigma within the riddle.
Right. Well, I've heard different theories about this. The Ahrar al-Sham is the biggest militia in the Aleppo in the north of Syria. And it has been the dominant group in this bigger collection of militias called the Islamic Front, which have provided this sort of central Islamist militia organization in Syria. We believe they have in total around 40 to 50,000 men. Their entire leadership was decapitated. Some people are pointing the finger at ISIS because ISIS has, as you said, blown up a bunch of their leaders before. Other people are pointing at the regime because it seems one theory put forward by a very smart analyst is that the regime bombed an arms depot that was right next to this this basement room, and that it set off a whole bunch of weapons, and that that gas from these weapons, you know, seeped into this basement area, this underground fortified meeting room, and asphyxiated the people there because their bodies were not blown apart. At first, people thought it was a suicide bomber who'd got in there with a vest and blown himself up in the room, but it doesn't seem to be that. It seems to be asphyxiation, and whether that's from chemical weapons or whether it's just from gases released by this explosion, we don't know. And those are unanswered questions. And it leads to the very complex battleground that Syria has turned into, and how difficult it will be to try to do anything to build responsible government in the region that's now occupied by ISIS.
But Joshua Landis, doesn't this logically lead you to conclude that if, as the president is asking Congress, this $500 million goes to arming and training some of this mosaic of militias that's supposedly on our side, but it doesn't seem like everybody's 100% on anybody's side in this war, then these weapons, some of them are going to end up in the hands of the Islamists or the people we're fighting against, as opposed to those that...
Well, that could well happen. And ISIS right now, many of their arms come from America because they conquered this third of Iraq, which had Iraqi military in them, many bases, all of which were equipped with American weaponry. And now ISIS has conquered that, taken many Humvees, very fancy advanced howitzers and guns and ammunition, all of which provided by the United States, and has used that to conquer much of Syria in the last few months.
But Joshua Landis, it seems that there's a paradox here. On the one hand, you have the Islamic State basically saying there are no borders anymore, and the Sykes-Picot post-World War I borders have been erased. In fact, they made a propaganda point of that by bulldozing the berm that separates Iraq and Syria. But here we are, you know, in fighting the Islamic State in Iraq, who are genocidal and have went after the Yazidis and the Christians. But in Syria, we may end up helping the people who want to murder the Christians and the small sects, the Druze and the others, and not to mention the Alawites. So how do you support rebels in Syria and not help them exterminate minorities?
Well, that's I don't know how you do that. You clearly are trying to vet people who say they will not do that. And whether they're saying that in order to get arms and money from the United States, and how the battlefield unfolds is unclear. Whether you just give them enough arms to take on ISIS, and then you have to monitor them and make sure that they're fighting ISIS and not, you know, spreading themselves down south and taking on the regime with the arms. Because the more failed state you have in Syria, the more ISIS is going to spread and conquer this territory. And if you look at the spread of ISIS, it really has profited from the fact that you've got failed states in Iraq and in Syria. And that's what spreads this al-Qaeda effect and these extremist militias. It's happened in Libya. It's happening in other places like in Afghanistan and so forth, or in Iraq after we destroyed the government there. Al-Qaeda spread dramatically. And one needs, ultimately, in order to roll back al-Qaeda and these extremist groups, to build a strong state that can provide an element of justice to its people and feed them and clothe them. And Syria is crying out for nation building. And it's the one thing that America does not want to get into doing, is to try to build another nation in the Middle East. We failed at that twice already. And that's why President Obama has really tried to restrict his ambitions to counterterrorism and not to nation building, even though that does seem to be inadequate in this situation.
Well, to be brutally honest, Joshua, aren't we involved and engaged in nation destroying, even if we're trying to find the good guys and arm them?
You know, in some ways we are, because the Islamic State today is building a government in this big expanse of land the size of Great Britain. And it's begun to issue traffic violation tickets. It's established a minister of petroleum. It just came out with a new school curriculum, a school curriculum that we would find abhorrent because it's very religious and it restricts, you know, science expression, and women are separated from men and so forth. And minorities are discriminated against. But it is building some stability in a state structure. We're going to destroy that. The responsible thing, of course, is to build a state in its place and to find some structure that can take it over, rather than to allow competing militias to fight over this territory, which will bring more death and destruction to the region. And this is, you know, this is the dilemma that we face as we engage in this sort of counterterrorism. We're going to be seeking and destroying, you know, ultimately, I guess, as one cynical friend of mine said, it seems like every 3 years we need to go kill crazy Arabs. And that, unfortunately, is the way I think much of the world is going to view what we're doing in Syria and Iraq.
Well, just in closing, Joshua Landis, is there a possibility that the main contract that Assad has with his people, particularly the minorities, Christians, Druze, etc., and his religious group, the Alawites, is that I'm going to protect you? And that was that's the theory behind the use of the chemical weapons that crossed Obama's red line, was that a bunch of Alawite villages had been massacred, and they let off these chemical weapons as a way to assure their own people that they were going to stand with them. And it would seem to me that if you're an Alawite or a Christian minority, you've got to be wondering whether Assad's brought nothing but grief to you, and that he's not really your guarantor. And since the Russians and the Iranians are backing him, and here we are working with the Iranians actually had boots on the ground recently in Amiral in Iraq. So they're working with the U.S., and the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, has sanctioned that. But then, you know, the Russians, on the other hand, we're not even talking to Putin anymore. He's so mad at us, and we're so mad at him. And he'd be the guy that you could actually probably work with to ease Assad out of there. So is there any chance that Assad's going to be eased out of there?
I don't believe so, not in the near future. Assad has been fairly strong. He owns more than half the people of Syria, and about half of the actual landmass of Syria is still under his control. Damascus, the capital city, the biggest city in Syria, is firmly under his control. He, of course, jumped at the American enmity towards ISIS and said he would like to be the partner with America to help destroy ISIS. We said, no, thank you. We've asked you to step aside. You've been butchering your own people. We said no. Russia then stood up and said, well, you cannot bomb Syria without, you know, this will be a contravening international law if you do it. And we can't get a resolution through the UN Security Council to bomb in Syria, to go after ISIS, without the support of Russia and China. They've said, we will give you that kind of a license if you work through the Syrian government. And so that's, you know, we've come to a loggerheads here with Russia, as you said. And because we've fallen out with Russia, we're not willing to work with Assad. We have the rebels as an alternative. But they are a disparate, internally, they're fighting amongst themselves. And they're not ideal partners. Neither is Assad, of course. And that leaves us really going it alone in Syria and sticking to the F-16s. We're not going to put boots on the ground, and we're going to try to avoid, you know, we're going to be chopping off the heads of the leadership. You know, it's a tough situation. It's a tough situation.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you. Thank you for asking me on.
Thank you. Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about why Americans choose war.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Oh no, oh well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Rubenstein, who is a University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 7 books, including Aristotle's Children and Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Rubenstein.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And it does seem that President Obama has chosen war, albeit reluctantly. He, after all, the president who promised to end the Iraq war and the Afghan war, and now he's being dragged back into a third Iraq war. And it sort of reminds me a bit of the Godfather's son, Michael, the heir. His famous remark was, just when I thought I was out of the family, they dragged me back in, you know?
Yeah, it's true. There's a parallel there.
So what do you think explains the kind of war fever in this country, even though it's conflicted, as we know? Americans don't want any more foreign involvement. On the other hand, they want their leaders to be macho and militant. So go figure.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I I argued in my book, In Reasons to Kill, that you don't usually get Americans to approve of a war by appealing to their narrow self-interest. You never say the word oil, for example, or you don't talk about money. You talk about really two things, especially. One is self-defense, and the other is moral obligation, and especially the obligation to intervene for humanitarian reasons. So if you take a parallel, if you take a situation like the Spanish-American War, you had the United States intervening in Cuba to save the Cubans from the Spanish, from the depredations of the Spanish, who were committing a kind of almost genocide against the Cuban people and trying to stop the Cuban independence movement. And then by a kind of strange logic, or by which I think we can understand, but it was not at all appreciated at the time, what looked to be a selfless humanitarian intervention turns into an imperialist adventure in which the United States not only takes over Cuba and does to the Cubans things that are just as bad as the Spanish were doing, but also takes over the Philippines and does things to the Filipinos that were even worse. It's as if we don't know, the left hand doesn't know, the left is the humanitarian hand, and it doesn't know what the right hand, which is the imperial hand, is doing or is going to do. Well, I think there's a parallel now. In fact, I think it's really the same situation now. We have an appeal to people to intervene, number one, on grounds which are very tenuous grounds of self-defense. I mean, President Obama said things like American security is at stake. What he's talking about, nobody really knows when he says that, because he admits in the same breath that there's no evidence of any threats against the homeland by ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, whatever you want to call them. So where is the self-defense? And ironically, of course, one thing that he doesn't talk about, or that nobody's talking about, is whether the kinds of activities that he's engaging in are likely to produce an attack on the homeland. The extent to which we're now running a risk that we weren't running a risk before of getting attacked here is something that, nobody's talking about at all. So the notion that somehow self-defense is involved really translates into defense of American values, or something much more abstract. But what it boils down to, I think, is that we are still operating an imperial system. So the reason Obama gets dragged, and as you say, dragged back into this, is that what's doing the dragging? It's not public opinion. I mean, public opinion is we didn't start out shouting for a war against ISIS. It's not pressure from Congress. There's been some pressure from McCain and other people who never met a war they didn't like. But there really is not what's exerting the magnetic pull is systemic. It seems to me it's an imperial system in which we are. Seem to be unable to figure out another way to relate to the world other than as the chief cop, the chief protector, the chief defender of Western values, the chief defender of oil company interests, and so forth. All of that puts us in the position of playing the imperial game, and the imperial game has been played by the same rules almost since Rome. And the principal rule is divide and conquer. Try to limit your own involvement, try to limit your own exposure. And the way you limit your own exposure is by trying to govern and to control things indirectly, which means arming certain groups against others. Then when this blows up in your face, as it keeps doing, not only do we basically destroy Iraqi society, but we turn Libya from an oppressive but reasonably well-ordered society into absolute chaos, a fragmented society where the only people who get what they want are the people who are exporting oil or importing oil. Everybody else is at everybody else's throat. So I understand that The Onion, my daughter told me today that The Onion is running a headline which says, Obama vows to split ISIS into many extremist groups. And I'm afraid that's what you know, that's what the effect of this sort of thing is, of that, you know, and especially in Syria.
Well, we already have that. Of course, our previous guest was walking us through that agony of Syria. We're not even sure who we're fighting for, with, and against. So I understand the tension, if you will, between the American Empire and the American Republic. And it's always, literally, since World War II, it's increasingly become a question of whether the Republic will survive the Empire. The idea that we're filling potholes in Kabul, Afghanistan, and not in Main Street, USA, I think is so absurd. And I think Obama got that. He pretty much ran on that platform of we need to fix stuff at home. But here he is being dragged back in to another war. And if we do have a permanent war economy, as you have implied, Richard Rubenstein, then one must assume then that the military-industrial complex runs America. But what I find extraordinary is that since World War II, we haven't won a war. So the traditional rationalization for wars, whether they were for good or ill, was always that you're going to win. Glorious victory, the parades, the ticker tape, etc. Johnny comes marching home. Well, since World War II, we've lost every war, and we're probably going to lose this one too. So what happened?
Well, one thing that happens, I think, is that when you're engaged in something very close to a kind of, I would say, a pure imperial form of conflict. The thing about empires is that they simply generate violence. It's a violence-generating system, and the kind of violence they generate is the violence of rebellion. Somebody is going to rebel against you as long as you're dominating them, as long as you're threatening their cultural autonomy, as long as you're arrogating to yourself the right to decide what they should import or export, or what goods should be produced, what things should cost, and all the rest. You're especially in a globalizing world. This is read by people all over the world as an immediate challenge to their identity, and no matter whether their politics are left, right, or center, or whether their religion is Islam or whatever else it might be, this comes down to them as an attack on basic human needs, the basic human need for identity and recognition and human development and autonomy, etc. So it's going to produce, violence. And the kind of violence it's going to produce is going to lead to a series of victories that are never final. Since you're stronger than them, we're stronger than them on the scale of ordinary military armaments, but they have an irrepressible will to be more autonomous and to be free, to make their own decisions. There can't be any end to this. There's no end to it. The only possible end to it is a different way of relating to other people in the world. So let me give you an example. The basic principle of conflict resolution that I preach and practice is that when you have serious differences that are producing violence, even though people have been killing each other over those differences, there's always a possibility that people are going to be able to sit down together, talk to each other, figure out what they really want and need, and figure out how they can redesign the system to get what they want and need. It's what's happened in Northern Ireland. It's happened in lots of places in the world for years and years. So you ask yourself, why can't it happen in the Middle East? What is the problem that prevents that from happening in the Middle East? Well, I think the first answer to that question is that we don't want those people over there to make decisions about their own region. That's it's the center of the world oil trade, also very rich in natural gas. It's a crossing point for world trade and world culture. We have not been willing to say, let's back off. Let us and other and would-be superpowers back off and figure out some way that these folks can be brought together in a way that permits them to make their own decisions. My friend Johan Galtung, the great Norwegian peacemaker, has been saying for years now that in the Middle East, when people talk about a two-state solution, Galtung says you can't have a two-state solution. You've got to have a six-state solution. At least you need to have a process by which people in the region get to work out their differences and decide what kind of arrangement can they live with, what kind of arrangement do they want. But you can't do that when you have outsiders telling folks what they have to do and defining their values for them. So that if you ask yourself, well, what's really going on in the Middle East? I mean, what's causing all of this violence? You would have to, you know, there are lots of answers, but there's not one answer that would not yield to a process in which people get to talk to each other and talk turkey about what they really want. For example, there's the question of the oil revenues and the oil production and the oil revenues, and those are questions who should do that and who should control it.
In Iraq, you're talking about.
Sure, but you know, also in Syria. Mm-hmm. Also, for that matter, in Saudi Arabia. Well, that's the last kind of discussion that the Saudis want to have, our Saudi allies. So what we're doing, instead of allowing discussion of issues like that, or for that matter, discussion of issues that involve Sunnis, the enormous conflict between Sunnis and Shia. How can the conflict between Sunnis and Shia be dealt with? Some people will say it can't be dealt with because these people are all such religious fanatics. You can't even get them to talk straight to each other because they're all in a religious frenzy. Then when you get people to actually sit down with them, and I've done it and other people in my field have done it, you sit down with people, you find out that's a stereotype. It's true of a few people and of a few groups that they may be so blinded by their own fixed beliefs that they're unable even to talk to people with different beliefs. Mostly they are the exception. They are not the rule. Most people are perfectly able to talk about what the roots of their conflict are, and they're so grateful, they're so happy to be given the chance to talk to each other like that without somebody saying, we're favoring this side over that side.
Well, you know,
we want this extremist Sunni group, this ISIS group, destroyed. So in order to do that, we're going to support maybe al-Nusra, which is just as extremist, almost just as extremist, maybe not quite. Or we're going to have the Saudis train something called the Free Syrian Army, which is actually a CIA operate, totally CIA-controlled operation. And we put ourselves in bed with the Saudis, who are the most reactionary government in the world. They are the 21st century equivalent of Tsarist Russia in the 19th century, is Saudi Arabia. That's our great democratic ally in the region. Mm. But are we then going to ally ourselves with Assad in Syria, who's also against ISIS? Are we going to ally ourselves with the Iranian government, which is probably the chief force opposed to extremist Sunni? No, we can't do that because we've decided that they're our enemies too. So you start to play this totally weird game in which you arm one extremist against another, and you refuse to deal with people who aren't so extremist because you've got imperial interests that cut against those kinds of alliances. Things get, what shall I say, not only more and more confused, but more and more unpredictable.
Well, I was going to say, when you're talking about sitting down with people and have, surprisingly, people that you considered beyond the pale actually turn out to be reasonable, we have a peculiar foreign policy standard where we don't talk to people unless, before we talk to them, they accept our conditions unilaterally up front. In other words, we have the, remember the Axis of Evil, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, wouldn't talk to them. And we'd only talk to them unless they decided to meet our standards, whatever they are. Israel has the same attitude towards Hamas. We can't talk.
Let me suggest something else too, which is a little nastier even than what you're suggesting, which is that not only, we moralize about who we're going to talk to and who we're not going to talk to, and we moralize about what our standards are that have to be met and before we're going to talk to you. But then we talk to them when we have to. We talk to them when we can't defeat them any other way. So we try to exterminate the Taliban. The Taliban turned out to be what people who knew anything about Afghanistan actually always knew. The Taliban turned out to be a deeply rooted movement, a movement with an ethnic basis, but other as well as an ideological base in Afghanistan. And at a certain point, it became apparent to everybody they're not going to. You can't defeat them. If that means destroying them and eliminating them and all of these other adjectives. And by the way, I think that Obama and the Americans have got to stop using words like cancer and disease to describe enemies. Over and over again, both Kerry and Obama are using this metaphor of cancer and disease. They seem to have forgotten that that's how the Jews, among other people, got exterminated in the 20th century, by being considered a disease, so that there was no form of violence that was too intense. If you're dealing with people who are basically representing contagious disease, you do what you have to defeat it. And it doesn't mean maybe you have to torture them. Maybe you have to kill them en masse. Maybe you have to massacre masses of people and not worry about collateral damage. I'm afraid that we're all being set up now to approve of what it makes me think of one of the greatest pieces of literature about imperialism, which is Conrad's story, Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness, right.
Where at the end of the story, you know, Kurtz, who's the guy, the civilized man who's sent into the back country to kind of represent the interests of the colonists, of the Belgians, he goes native, right, as it were. And at the end of the story, the only thing left of him, aside from a pile of skulls, is a notebook. And there's one thing written in the notebook, and what it says in the notebook is, "Exterminate the brutes."
Well, of course, that became the basis of the movie Apocalypse Now, which was about
exactly
U.S. involvement in Vietnam. But just in the last minute, Richard Rubenstein, what seems to be somewhat different about this situation in terms of imperialism, it's not so much about resources, etc., although they are involved in the Middle East, obviously, but it just seemed to have a religious basis, and it almost goes back to medieval times with the Crusades or the 30-year war in Europe between the Protestants and the Catholics. It's got a religious component. So how do you deal with that?
Well, maybe one way to start is to recognize why religion has become such an important feature of politics in certain parts of the world, including the Middle East. And very often, religion becomes that important when it starts to be the carrier of all sorts of other political values. When, for example, you go around the world and destroy movements of national liberation that are secular and get rid of the socialists and the communists and so forth, and you still have people in their home country that want to try to defend their own values and their own, you know, develop some means of making their own decisions, well, what banner should they organize under? Religion's the only game in town. Once the West has you know, finished their this kind of job of making the whole region, in a way, politics-free, secular politics-free, or they bought and paid for the secular politicians so that the secular politicians are in disgrace because they're all considered to be foreign stooges and bribable, then the religious people appear, and this is so important, I think. I'm glad you asked me the question, because the notion that you can deal with ISIS simply as a terrorist group, that is to say a group that relies only on force and terrorizes everybody into doing what they want, and that's why they have power, it's absolutely ridiculous, and this is a serious error. ISIS, the ISIS people are not nice. I don't carry any kind of brief for them, but you also have to realize that they have a popular base, and the reason they've developed a popular base is because they're able to pose, at least, as authentic representatives of people who want independence, who want the foreigners out of their country, who want law and order, who want a court system that actually works when people commit crimes, who want leadership that's not simply bribable and that's not in the pay of, you know, some foreign company or some foreign government. ISIS is saying to the people in their region the same thing that that Maoist said for when they were taking power in China. We are in a position to give you the first clean government you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. We're in a position to have a court system, which, although it's going to be harsh, you know, where this justice is going to be harsh, it's still going to be delivered.
Sure. Well, look, Richard,
you can't defeat them. If you want to defeat them or have them have other people replace them, you can't do that unless you understand what the basis of their appeal is to people in their own region, and that's part of the basis of their appeal. So to call them terrorists is a way of, I would say, almost deliberately misunderstanding what the basis of their appeal is and their power is.
Well, Richard Rubenstein, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Rubenstein, who's a University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 7 books, including Aristotle's Children and Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the other 9/11.
Paraste frente a mí, que te habías enamorado hace unos años sin decirme nada. Entonces la emoción confirma el sentimiento. Y qué mala suerte en el amor, ni buena suerte en el juego. Y si al final lo que hay que vivir, lo que hay que soñar, hay que vivirlo, te vuelvo a dar la gracia.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Catherine Hyde, who's a professor of political science and the chair of political science at Vassar College, where she focuses on Latin American politics, social movements, and the legacies of violence for governments and societies in transition. She's the co-author of The Politics of Memory in Chile, From Pinochet to Bachelet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Hyde.
Thank you very much.
And this is the 41st anniversary of the coup against Salvador Allende, the military coup that toppled the socialist president in 1973. And there were some violent clashes in Chile. A few days ago, there was a bombing in a shopping mall. Apparently, there's been about 200 sort of suspicious bombs going off, mostly in the middle of the night, often attributed to anarchists. But in terms of Martin Luther King's famous adage that the arc of the universe bends slowly towards justice, in terms of Chile, in terms of truth, reconciliation, and justice, it's been a pretty long arc, and I'm not sure that anybody's particularly satisfied with the results.
Yeah, no, that's right. It has been a very long arc, and it has bent. As the kind of product of a long series of efforts, primarily from the grassroots of Chile, to really remember, to get at the truth of what happened, both with the coup and under the 17-year dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. But now we have 20 years since the transition from Pinochet, when he stepped aside in 1990, and we're looking now at a process in which actually several former military officers have been prosecuted. There are a series of Truth Commission reports that have come out, government commission reports. The first one as early as 1991, when the government did issue a report on the disappeared and executed. And then more recently, a very important series of reports on torture, on the tens of thousands of Chileans who were tortured during the dictatorship. So it's been a long road, but in terms of questions of truth and justice, there have been some accomplishments thanks to the human rights movement in Chile, to some brave journalists and lawyers and family members of those whose loved ones were killed. And it's also been a time where there has been movement both to try to deal with a lot of the legacy of the dictatorship in terms of political economy, in terms of an extreme neoliberal set of policies that Pinochet put in place. So the current government, led by Michelle Bachelet, who herself is the daughter of a former Chilean military officer who was killed in the first months after the coup, a constitutionalist general that was not in favor of Pinochet being in power. She herself, now reelected, she has been trying to orchestrate a series of important reforms, particularly education reforms and tax reforms. And again, that was very much triggered by a very active student movement that really resurrected the progressive project of the pre-military coup, 1973 years. The projects that were much more about an equal education. And there has now been some success, so I think that's a long way of saying yes. The arc has moved, has been slowly, but there have been some important movements, again, recognizing the damage of the years of the dictatorship on all kinds of levels of society and an attempt to recover some dignity and less inequality in society.
Now, military dictators, more often than not, from Pinochet to Mubarak to the Assad mafia clan in Syria at the moment, Gaddafi, you name it, they're also kleptocrats. So what kind of economic justice? You mentioned their extreme neoliberal programs of the Milton Friedman experiments, etc.
Exactly.
But what about, I think, isn't it Pinochet's son-in-law that's now being investigated? I mean, he's a billionaire, for God's sake.
Well, Pinochet's family has experienced prosecution. Interestingly, in terms of some of the work that was done to trace some money to follow the money in terms of the U.S. Patriot Act, what was uncovered was some bank accounts tied to the Pinochet family, Riggs Bank in Washington D.C. And that started to expose, you know, many people tried not to see Pinochet as economically corrupt. There was a sense that, yes, there had been some abuses in human rights, but that somehow he had been a savior of the economy. And he was actually, you know, today there was a piece about declassified documents that show that the Reagan administration was ready to offer Pinochet asylum in the late 80s because they were concerned. They felt he had done a good job of righting the economy and felt that it was time to go before there was more of a move to the left than the administration desired. And so there was pressure. But Reagan wanted to congratulate Pinochet on his economic policies. But yes, today there's been a number of revelations and some prosecutions of the Pinochet family for the economic corruption, for clearly great amounts of money that were amassed by the family during the dictatorship.
Well, I recall that Pinochet almost went on trial when he was held in London, but eventually Margaret Thatcher relented because she felt that somehow she owed Pinochet a favor for helping out during the Falklands Malvinas war that the British had with Argentina. But given some of the prominent poets and folk singers that were brutally murdered, and I believe one of the murderers of the famous folk singer is
Victor Jara.
Mm-hmm. Victor Jara, yeah. He's, mm-hmm. he's I believe, resides in Florida. So mm-hmm. what's going on there in terms of
right.
that kind of justice?
Well, as you say, in 1998, in October of 98 in London, so that was actually under the Tony Blair administration, Pinochet was having an operation, and there had been a concerted series of efforts, primarily from the Spanish magistrate Garzón, in conjunction with many important judges and investigators, lawyers and families from Chile and in Spain, that had been working very systematically over years to this point. And so Pinochet was held for many months in London, and ultimately, for medical reasons, allowed to return to Chile. And in that time, that opened up a great deal of new space. It was a very important symbolic moment. No one ever thought that, in spite of the international pariah figure that Pinochet was, that he could ever really be held personally accountable for the criminal acts under the dictatorship. And yet here he was being held under house arrest in London. And it meant that there were, in the media and the kind of popular imagination of Chile for the first time, there were stories that were told on television and in the press about the family's losses and people who had been tortured. It just was like something opened. And for the first time, or virtually the first time, Chilean judges recognized that the act of disappearance, there was no statute of limitations on disappearance, that it was sort of a continued crime. And that allowed the prosecution of a number, the processing of many, many military officers. In the case of Victor Jara, yes, there were actually very recently new prosecutions. And you're right that there is one of the men implicated in the murder of Victor Jara, who was in the United States, and that is being pursued still as we speak. The Victor Jara case is very, very powerful because it also raises the questions about military conscripts who were ordered to kill Jara, and we now have the gruesome details of how he died. And yes, he was a very beloved folk singer. He was also married to Joan Jara, a British citizen. So it had a lot of international currency and meaning and power. And the fact that all these many years later, decades later, justice is being continued to be pursued is very important.
Well, Catherine Hyde, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Hyde, who's a professor of political science and the chair of political science at Vassar College, where she focuses on Latin American politics, social movements, and the legacies of violence for governments and societies in transition. She's the co-author of The Politics of Memory in Chile, From Pinochet to Bachelet. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.